This is a segment from The Annex, an academic sociology-themed podcast. For more, visit us on the web at theannexpodcast.com. And now we turn to David Peterson of Northwestern University. David is a sociologist of knowledge and science. He's best known for his 2015 article in ASR, All This Solid Bench Building at the Frontiers of Two Experimental Sciences. His newer work talks about trust and the moral economy. David, thank you very much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So can you tell us a little bit about your larger intellectual project?
Sure. I think I got into the project largely. I listened to the podcast a couple weeks ago, and you had Steve Vasey on, and he was talking a little bit about the need for sociologists to sort of reach out across disciplinary boundaries and integrate more work from the decision sciences, cognitive sciences, psychology into the field. So I started this project really with that goal. And so I started to go into labs to sort of learn more about how psychology operated. And what I found is that the work they were doing was much more complicated than the papers I was reading. I was getting a much different view within the labs than from the papers, from the sort of conclusions that I was reaching from the papers. And so it started to give rise to a set of questions about, well, what is so challenging? What is so different about, let's say, laboratory work on human beings as psychology experiments than, let's say, experiments in a natural science environment. So this really motivated a larger study where I conducted a comparative ethnography with 10 different psychology laboratories and one natural science laboratory, a molecular biology lab, to see what was going on at the level of practices that could kind of explain some of the challenges that psychology was having.
What, can you, just for those who haven't read your article, can you explain some of the differences?
Yeah. So one of the things that you see sort of jumps out at you most explicitly, I think, is really radical distinctions in the role of both technique and technology, both the role of sort of embodied knowledge, of tacit skill, and the rapid development and the rapid incorporation of technology. And I argue that the molecular biology lab and really most kind of natural science labs have high levels of both embodied skill and or a technology incorporation, whereas in psychology labs you have much lower levels of this. And I think what happens is that this creates a very different cultures where you have one that's kind of this very rapid developing a culture focused around the development of new technological manipulations, and another which is focused on a different kind of knowledge production, one that I'm still sort of grappling with, but I think is one that I think we need to understand better as sociologists.
What do we as sociologists have to learn from the natural sciences? Is there anything that you've sort of in your grappling with us versus them? Is there any reflection on maybe things that we could be doing differently, or is it possible?
I think there's certainly a couple sides to this issue. One, when I went into the first article I ever published actually was an article that used a lot of a developmental cognitive science to critique sort of classic arguments by social constructionists, really exemplified by Durkheim's work on the social foundations of basic cognitive concepts like cause and force and all of these things, essentially arguing that these things don't emerge in the social world, that you can see them in infants. So when I went into the developmental psychology labs, I started to realize that I had been accepting a lot of these findings somewhat uncritically. And I think this is a somewhat problematic relationship that sociology has because of its sort of low status in the sciences, that it's very willing to kind of read these articles and sort of take the conclusions as they stand and not really understand how even within the field, those conclusions are not nearly as black and white as they would appear on the printed page. And so I think that's one side of it. On the other side, I think we really have to do a better job of because we aren't in this business of producing technological products like most of the natural sciences are, I think we tend to focus more on questions of methodology. It's not so much the end as we tend to focus on the means of scientific production. And I think sociologists do not do a very good job of we are falling behind our sort of sister sciences in openness, in sharingness, in transparency, in issues that the other fields, I think, are confronting much more head on.
Like, can you give us some concrete examples of what we could be doing?
Yeah, I think so. In a lot of the psychology journals, one of the things they're doing now is they're implementing a badge system. And so the idea is that if you publish research and you share your data or materials, that there will be some sort of badge on the paper, and it will be kind of like a mark of virtue that essentially, you know, that if you want to, you can go out and you can find everything and you can try to reproduce the findings on your own, as you were talking about before with the Reinhardt and Rogoff piece. This is one of the things they're doing. And there's not a lot of good reason for not doing that in many cases for sociological articles, especially when you're dealing with things like a large scale data sets like the General Social Survey or something. There's not a lot of good reason for not sharing your code and things like that.
Yeah, although ironically, you're using a methodology where that wouldn't be appropriate because there's all sorts of ethical problems with posting field notes.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it's really great. I mean, it's a very interesting ethical dilemma.
Well, what do qualitative researchers do?
So I think the question with qualitative research is somewhat different than with quantitative research. Because I think ultimately the question with a lot of qualitative research is not about, you know, making some sort of ironclad causal argument. I think...
Yeah, you're not trying to get people to replicate your results.
Exactly. Yeah. Jeremy Fries and I actually just wrote an annual review article on replication. And it was interesting. Initially we were thinking about talking about qualitative research in the same context. And we realized that it deserved its own section because the issue of replication in qualitative research is so different because it's just a different sort of research. And I think the goal of a lot of qualitative research is ultimately to convince people about the nature of some phenomenon, that this is the way things work. These are the variables that are important. These are the differences that are important. And I think, you know, that eventually can give rise to some sort of quantitative research, which can be replicated and which can produce, you know, something that looks more like quantitative science.
But if that's the case, then what is the difference between a sociologist doing qualitative research and a journalistic account?
I think the question has to do to some degree with theory, with the role of theory, the idea that you are developing in a certain tradition, that you are working with, deeper, more sort of theoretical concepts, and you aren't just sort of giving a very sort of flat account. For instance, the article on in the American Sociological Review, for instance, that is focused on sort of a tradition of laboratory studies. It embraces stuff about materiality. It engages with stuff on tacit knowledge. So it's not just a sort of journalistic account.
This distinction of what distinguishes long form journalism from ethnography being theory, kind of implicit in that seems to be a turn that I see with a lot of younger ethnographers away from thick description, and which I think is welcome because I find thick description boring.
Can you explain that to those of us who aren't as deep into qualitative work?
Well, I'm not a qualitative person either, so I could explain it. But I mean, my caricature of thick description is that you try to, so grounded theory is you go in without strong theoretical preconceptions, but thick description takes it one step forward in that even coming out of it, you don't really have a theory hook. You're just like, you know, trying to like capture somebody. You're just trying to capture the sensation of having been there. Mm-hmm. And so you're telling people all about the subjective experiences of these people's lives, but almost as a point of principle, you resist broad theory hooks and having it speak to larger theoretical questions.
Yeah, I think... One of the really fascinating things about the molecular biology lab that I was surprised about was how much they engaged in kind of qualitative discussions about the data they gathered. That often they would be taking these pictures or be getting some form of data that was way too noisy to, you know, show any kind of a clear pattern. And they would all stand around and sort of try to interpret what was happening, you know, a very sort of qualitative understanding of what was happening. And then from that, they would go back into the lab and, you know, they would tweak a couple of things and attempt to redo the experiment to attempt to reduce the noise. And I think, in a sense, qualitative sociology sort of operates in the same way, where I think, to some degree, you know, you need this kind of direct, thick engagement in order to better understand, you know, which variables are actually important. So, you know, when you want to do, I mean, I don't think qualitative sociology as an end in itself makes a ton of sense, because then you end up with something like journalism. It has to produce something that I think that can be meaningful for, let's say, more quantitative oriented sociologists.
Well, that's what's nice about your work, right, is that it's qualitative, but you can easily imagine it fitting very well with like a computer simulation of p-hacking or publication bias or that sort of thing. So it's like, even though you're using completely different methods than Christobel Young, I would be surprised to see your paper cited and not his in the future, because you're doing things that conceptually go towards the same endpoint.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and my advisor, Jeremy Fries, is his main focus. I mean, he's a quantitative methodologist, and I think it's been very helpful. We have a couple of projects working together, and I think that it's been very helpful working with him on that, because I think that's the way his mind works. I mean, he definitely demands where is this going? How is this going to, you know, how is this going to help other people?
Yeah, and not only is Jeremy a quantitative methodologist, but he's also substantively oriented towards social psych and evolutionary psych, which are some of the fields you're criticizing.
Absolutely.
Or, well, not criticizing, but unpacking.
Yes.
I have to say, I thought there was a lot to chew on your qualitative work, and I found it very thought-provoking in a lot of ways. And one thing that struck me was the natural scientist's focus on data quality, which I sort of inferred wasn't as strong in the social sciences.
Yeah, absolutely. So earlier I mentioned this sort of increase, big variation in the level of technique and technology in the natural sciences. And the larger argument there is that what that is for is it's for altering the conditions of data collection. That, you know, imagine a sociologist coming up with a survey. How much work can you do on that survey? How many, you know, trial runs can you do with that survey? How many times can you reorder questions and reword a question before you kind of, you know, have tapped out all of your possibilities? That situation isn't the same as that which faces a natural scientist. For them, they are able to continue to add new things to their investigative procedures. They're able to transform the site of data collection in a way that is extremely difficult for most social scientists.
Do you think that we're really limited, though, or do you think it's a failure of imagination on our part and a lack of focus on data quality? Because I could imagine there's an infinite number of ways that you can alter, you know, the conditions that you administer surveys or how you deliver them. I can think of at least a variety of ways, but I don't see people trying to reimagine the survey on the scale that I inferred your natural scientists to be reimagining their instruments, you know, and their data collection.
Yeah, it's a great question. I think there is a lot of possibility here. I think there are a couple of natural sort of limitations, and in the article I talk about them as, on one hand, you have sort of ethical limitations as to what you can actually do with a human subject, you know, whereas with a mouse you can you pretty much have free reign with what you do, with how you manipulate, how you control the environment that the mouse is raised in. A human being essentially comes as a fully formed, you know, creature into your lab, and the only sort of control you have is, you know, you can provide them with some sort of instructions, which I think is obviously quite limited. Another aspect I think has to do with the ontological features of a lot of social scientific work, which is that we are dealing a lot of times with kind of meaningful concepts, categories like race or power, and these things don't lend themselves to sort of endless tinkering and reduction into finer and finer components. And so I think those two things, I think, do provide some natural limitations to social scientific experimentation. That being said, though, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, things like people using methods like giving subjects apps on their cell phone that they check in periodically. You know, this is like a new way that some social psychologists are gaining more access, gaining more purchase on their experimental object.
So I wanted to ask about the Baby Factory paper that was published in Socius.
Sure.
I thought that paper was a lot of fun. And one reason it really resonated with me is that when my daughter, who's now 10, was, 6 months old, I took her to one of the infant cognition labs at Harvard twice. It was really interesting to see them do the work, because one of the two times the experiment worked as normal. She was a cooperative experimental subject. And, correct me if I'm wrong, but basically the way that these baby methodologies work is they do a puppet show for the baby. And something about the puppet show is a little bit off. And by seeing whether the baby appears surprised when something weird happens, they can tell what the baby was anticipating and therefore what the baby was thinking. So, for instance, if you have two objects go behind a screen and three come out and the baby is not surprised by this, you can infer that the baby doesn't know how to count.
Exactly. Yes.
Yeah. So one of the two times that I took my daughter there, and again, this is when she was very young. I think she'd perform better now. She's, in fifth grade. She sat on my lap and she stared at the jar of salsa, and the little puppet tries to pick up the jar of salsa and this and that. And she looked at it, and, you know, they could track her eye movement. She seemed to be a cooperative experimental subject. And then the other time they tried to do it, she just like wasn't interested. She was just like, sucking on her fist or something the whole time. And the grad student who was doing the experiment basically said, well, that's okay. Sometimes we have to throw out a case. And I was thinking, well, wait a minute, how do you know that this wasn't, I kind of inferred that they were doing the control condition, and the dependent variable in these studies is basically always some variation on the baby gets bored and stop paying attention. And I'm thinking, like, well, how do you know that that wasn't meaningful, not paying attention, and not, like, she wasn't paying attention because she was an uncooperative subject, right? How do you know that this is missing data, not a zero? And they basically made the operational decision. And then I was telling one of my grad students, David Scheiber, yesterday about your paper, and he's like, oh, I took my daughter to one of these baby labs, and the exact same thing happened to me. So, with both my personal experience and that of one of my students, it seems very similar to what you're finding in your paper.
Yeah, I mean, when I started observing in the labs, I had been reading a sociologist of science who had done laboratory ethnographies, and a lot of that work sort of focuses on the fact that, okay, you have this philosophy of science, of how science is supposed to work, and when you actually go into the labs, it tends to be quite a bit, more interpretive, and findings are kind of more emergent than they are, sort of predetermined by some scientific methodology. But when I was observing in the baby lab, I was like, it's not quite chaos, but like a controlled chaos, as you would expect when, there's like a small group of rooms where you've got three or four babies and a bunch of, siblings and a bunch of parents around, and it doesn't look like science. And then you realize that, a lot of these, a lot of this sort of, there's a lot of researcher fiat going on, a lot of researchers kind of making decisions about what counts, what doesn't count, what counts as the baby becoming interested or not. I think when the paper came out, some of the social psychologists were a little upset about, thinking that I was essentially saying that what they were doing was so different from what happens in a physics lab or in a chemistry lab. And ultimately I think, that you see the same sort of interpretations and the same researcher decisions that happen in those other labs, but you would expect them to be more prevalent in a lab that works on, you know, 6-month-old babies. I mean, it's yeah. and it seems crazy to expect anything else.
Yeah. So do you so what's the practical upshot? Do you think that, you know, the documentary The Human Baby or like copies of Pinker's How the Mind Works should have like a warning sticker on the front? Or not literally, but I mean, do you think that this implies that maybe it turns out that babies can't count at 6 months, they count at 9 months or whatever? Like, do you think some of these findings are probably wrong because there's so many researcher degrees of freedom, especially in things like when do you kick a case?
Yeah, so I at the end of the baby factory paper, I tackle this really explicitly, and the argument that I make there is that if you just read the sort of written literature, you're likely to come away with an overinflated idea of what the field has done. I think, mm-hmm. though, that within the field, that sort of through the network of the field, you get a different sense of what is and what isn't truth. And so you have a sense that certain findings that got through the publication process may not be replicable. And they may, you know, whether you consider those just, you know, false or whether you consider them, you know, fragile findings is up for debate. But the idea is that you wouldn't, you know, probably pursue those findings in your own work because they wouldn't, you know, they wouldn't replicate, they wouldn't help you out. And so in a sense, there's sort of a network of knowledge that's occurring, even though a lot of the publication stuff may be overinflated or maybe flat wrong. There's still a sense that through, you know, these communication networks, there's still a sense of okay, you know, these findings at least are robust. We can work with these. And so I think this may end up being, you know, somewhat problematic that there is this sort of, you know, disjuncture between the publication literature and what people know within the field to be true and not true. But I think in fields like a developmental psychology that maybe don't have, you know, sort of immediate pressing ramifications for, you know, policy issues, let's say, that it may not be, you know, such a massive issue.
But it is interesting that at the abstract level, what you're talking about is a tacit knowledge issue, and that one dimension of tacit knowledge is kind of a rough sense of how reliable different findings are.
Oh yeah, I mean it really has multiple problems, I think, because you know, it's very helpful, I think, for you to be in a central location at that point, because if you are at a university or in a laboratory that has very good network connections, you're likely to hear about what doesn't work and what does work. Whereas if you are on a more peripheral location, you might, you know, you may be reading these articles assuming that all of these things are true, and you may spend, you know, most of your graduate career failing to replicate a finding that everybody already knows is false. And so it has...
So if we were to assume that it becomes possible to somehow, you know, more possible to publish failed replications, right? Mm-hmm. Let's say that it was easy to publish null findings. This implies that a meta-analysis would find more null findings from people at the periphery of science than at the core of science.
That's an interesting hypothesis. I mean, I don't know. Yeah, that's a. I think that's a really interesting hypothesis.
Hi, David. So I have a question for you. Considering that you know, you were in laboratories like that, but then you're also in the molecular bio lab. And one of the things that I've been fascinated by is, you know, especially over the past like 7 to 8 years, more and more the quote unquote hard sciences have been experiencing their own replication crises. You know, more and more we've been seeing things, studies that have been published in leading biology journals, you know, health journals, etc., in which, you know, findings just can't be replicated. And I'm wondering if a lot of the same things that you're seeing, even in like the crazy baby labs, right, where it's really hard to sort of herd cats or toddlers, as it were, you know, a lot of the same things are happening in these labs. I mean, it seemed to me that that's part of what you were saying earlier, that, you know, there is, I mean, there's definitely this process of interpretation, right? First order, second order interpretation that actually might then leave room for things to actually not be in, replicated.
That's a great point. I mean, I think a lot of the incentive structures that you see in the psychology labs exist in the scientific field itself. So it raises the question, you know, what would make these psychology labs different? And I think on one hand, I think the reason why we're seeing the rise of all of this activism in psychology is because psychology has always been at the forefront of methodological revolutions because they've always been the sort of softest of the hard sciences. I think they were the first ones to sort of embrace statistical methodology, for instance. And it was precisely because, you know, it gave them a certain, you know, scientific cachet. I think, though, that with some of the hard sciences, like in molecular biology, I think one of the reasons why they're maybe facing a separate set of issues is because if you are focused on the development of new technologies, of manipulations, it's somewhat... if you produce something, if you produce some new mechanism for dying cells, for instance, other labs want to use that right away because it furthers their own research projects. If your method doesn't actually do anything, then everyone's going to know that the paper that you published is nonsense. And so replication for these labs is not just an issue of kind of abstract, you know, is it true or not, but a sort of existential question of I need to use this for my own work. And so, it's not for the social sciences. Replication tends to take more of a verification sort of approach, where it's almost a test of truthfulness. And I think that in sciences that have more of a technological focus, a replication sort of serves a different purpose for them.
Like a borrowing of practical.
Yes, exactly. And in psychology and in our own field, you don't see that as much. When somebody replicates somebody else's work, it often is seen as almost an attack on that person. It can be, quite interpersonally problematic.
Well, you know, goes back to the whole Amy Cuddy thing. And, you know, it's like vilifying somebody maybe instead of just taking the lesson. Is there any way you could see us adopting a more practical disposition? This is for anybody, within our own discipline, getting some type of cumulative methodological sort of...
So Duncan Watts actually just wrote an article where he essentially made that same argument, that what we need to do is we need to be focused on more sort of tangible, practical things that our knowledge can actually do rather than, abstract, you know, strictly academic knowledge, which doesn't really translate toward policy in any kind of meaningful way. And so I think it's an interesting argument. I don't know. I am not sure whether the field will actually move that way or not, but I think at least some people are thinking in that direction.
So,
well, I mean, I think that, there are people who are doing just that, you know, it's just that not everyone thinks that what we do needs to be practical, right? Or have any practical, significance.
You know, that a lot of times there's some sort of Andrew Abbott, professional regress, where I think that doing practical work is kind of seen as more low status, whereas, you know, the more abstract, you know, theoretical stuff is respected more.
Yeah, I I kind of don't get that either, right? I mean, I get doing the abstract stuff because you love it, but I also get I guess you should get some kudos for that. But I also get doing the practical stuff because it actually is used to push society forward. I don't know. Is that not a goal?
Well, I think that we have there's a lot of fetishizing these grand theorists of the 19th century, and everybody wants to be, you know, Karl Marx reincarnate, something like that with these wide ranging theories. And maybe the nuts and bolts just aren't part of, I don't know, the collective imagination of the discipline, this idea that we could all just be pluggers, you know?
Yeah, but didn't Marx himself say, right? You know what I mean? It's like, to paraphrase, what's the point in just describing the world and doing all this abstract crap if we're not going to change it?
I was just going to say that, like, in how we underappreciate the methodological and tinkering aspect, I have like a lecture where, you know, so I teach a media class at UCLA, and in one of them I have this lecture on how people in the media actually make decisions, and part of it actually talks about Lazarsfeld, because he had all these side projects where he worked with CBS to develop like focus group methodology and that sort of thing. And I always tell them that, like, you know, everything that you just learned in your 101 class across the street, you know, in the next lecture hall is total nonsense. That doesn't actually influence what we did. It's all influenced by Lazarsfeld, but we have this weird intellectual history where it's all grand theorists rather than, you know, here's the people who introduce the methodology that actually structures how we spend our days.
For more, visit us on the web, theannexpodcast.com.